Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. No one now argues that the war in Iraq has gone well, far from it. Even the president's comments are peppered with warnings of failure and nightmare scenario. But the showstopper in Washington is what to do. What to do about the worst of scenarios that now looks all too possible, even near. An Iraqi descent into all-out civil war with raging spillover threatening the entire region with its giant powder keg of Sunni-Shia tension, Israel, and a huge portion of the oil that powers the world. The record of history on stopping or containing civil wars is bleak. But the stakes are too high not to try at least to staunch the spillover. Up next, On Point, containing catastrophe in Iraq. I will be joined in a moment by Kenneth Pollack from the Brookings Institution and Barry Posen from MIT's Security Studies Program. But first, joining me now from Washington is Noam Levy, congressional correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He's been following the multi-front battle in the Senate over President Bush's move to send more troops to Iraq. Noam Levy, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Give us the lay of the land, if you would. A lot of resolutions out there, but in brief, what is afoot here, and does it look like it might stop the president's plans or not?
Let me try to explain what the many negotiations that are going on here look like. We have a couple of resolutions that are being drafted that have been proposed already, critical of the president's plan, both of them bipartisan, both of them receiving a warm reception on the Democratic side of the aisle. As well as a number of Republicans. Then we also have some efforts underway by a number of Republican senators, including John McCain, to craft alternative resolutions, which may not be quite as critical and which may put may express slightly different sentiments. So all of this in the mix right now. Senate leaders are negotiating over how these will be brought forward to the floor, when the debate will happen, what exactly will be debated. This being the Senate, nothing is entirely clear until it actually happens.
We've got a Biden-Hagel resolution, a Warner resolution, a Feingold resolution that would cut off money to deploy U.S. troops in Iraq after half a year or so. And then, as you say, McCain-Graham pushing back, more supportive of the president, but looking for benchmarks. Do any of these, are any of these targeted at actually stopping the buildup the president is in the midst of now, Noam?
Well, I think the important thing to keep in mind is that this is a multi-stage process. Initially, these resolutions you mentioned, Biden, Hagel, Warner, even McCain, John Cornyn of Texas, an ally of the White House, these would be non-binding type resolutions, essentially expressing the sense of the Senate. It's an approach that sort of senators take when they don't want to go too far, but at the same time believe that their expression of opinion will carry some weight with the White House. You mentioned Senator Feingold is proposing to ultimately cut off funding. That I would put in the second stage here. There are a number of senators, all Democrats, who believe that an expression of opinion by the Senate, or for that matter the House of Representatives, are merely words, and that the Congress has a responsibility to go further, to use the power at its disposal to actually either stop the escalation of troops now or ultimately, as Senator Feingold is proposing, to begin forcing the president to begin withdrawing troops from Iraq.
Let's listen to just a little bit of Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold in the Senate Judiciary's hearing yesterday.
Since the president is adamant about pursuing his failed policies in Iraq, Congress has the duty to stand up and use its power to stop him. If Congress doesn't stop this war, it's not because he doesn't have the power. It's because it doesn't have the will.
Senator Feingold saying, let's use the purse. Republican Senator Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania at the Senate Judiciary Committee also spoke to War Powers, also critical.
I would suggest and suggest respectfully to the president that he is not the sole decider, that the decider is a shared and joint responsibility.
Noam, again, on the deployment of the 21,000 troops the president's talking about, is that moving ahead anyway? Is this all over the horizon, sort of about future political positioning, future deployments, or might it actually come to bear on these immediate steps?
Well, I think it's been made fairly clear by the administration and by the Pentagon that the deployment of these additional troops is a fairly long process. It will take several months. It's even not fair to call it a deployment, because in some sense the troop levels will be built up by retaining some troops that are already in Iraq as others come in. So it will take some time for that to happen. It is also, I should say, underway, however. So whenever Congress gets to acting, they may be able to arrest some of that additional buildup. However, it's important to note that if the Senate does get to a point where they're actually debating steps to cut funding, to withhold funding, that would require not only a majority in the House and in the Senate, but it would presumably require a two-thirds veto-proof majority, because I can't imagine that the president would sign any kind of legislation that would tie his hands and how he can operate. So that's a very complicated and difficult proposition for Democrats, since their majorities in both the Senate and the House are pretty narrow.
The tremendous ferment on Capitol Hill right now. Noam Levy with the Los Angeles Times. Thanks for bringing us up to date.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Joining me now from Washington is Kenneth Pollack, Director of Research at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He's former Director for Persian Gulf Affairs at the National Security Council and author of The Threatening Storm, The Case for Invading Iraq. On Monday, he released the report with Dan Byman, Things Fall Apart, containing the spillover from an Iraqi civil war. Kenneth Pollack, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
How close are we to this all-out civil war, which would threaten regional spillover, in your view?
Well, the problem with these kind of civil wars is that when you look at them historically, it's always difficult to tell. Civil war tends to come upon you very quickly. Typically, there is some event that honestly no one could have predicted the day before that simply triggers a psychological dynamic and propels you very quickly into the throes of civil war. What we've seen in Iraq is a low-level civil war that's been going on for at least the last year and a half or so, and you've seen a number of events, most notably the bombing of the Mosque of the Golden Dome in Samarra last February, that could easily have been that kind of a psychological trigger. So when Dan and I looked at Iraq and we compared that to about a dozen other recent civil wars, we basically said the trajectory is a very bad one, and we are so far along it that pretty much any event could trigger that kind of a rapid descent.
You're waving the red flag very hard here. You write, the U.S. effort to bring peace and stability to Iraq has failed. You write, Iraq is rapidly descending into an all-out civil war. And if that goes to spillover, what does that spillover potentially look like?
Well, spillover from Iraq could be very bad. Again, we looked at about a dozen different instances of civil wars in the last 30 years and how they affected neighboring states. And what we found is that spillover is a constant from civil wars. Now, the intensity can vary. In some cases, it's merely unpleasant and annoying. But in other cases, it can become truly catastrophic. In other cases, civil war in one country can actually cause civil war in another country, or civil war in one country can devolve into a larger regional war. And unfortunately, when we looked at Iraq, we found that Iraq actually has all the hallmarks of a state that probably will tend toward the worse end of the spectrum. And of course, we are already seeing signs of pretty much every aspect of spillover that we identified in these historical cases. We're already seeing them in Iraq to a greater or lesser extent.
So you're not talking spillover that means reaching for a paper towel. You're talking catastrophic as a real possibility and potentially imminent. Very quickly, give us sort of some of the bullet points, ingredients of what that could look like.
Well, spillover, we identified six basic patterns that come from spillover. They're things like refugees. Now, refugees not only are a humanitarian catastrophe, but they also are a strategic problem. We need to think about refugees as being large numbers of very unhappy people, and they are a prime recruiting pool for militia groups, for terrorists. As a result, the refugee population, the refugee camps, can then become staging ground for new attacks back into the country. They provoke attacks on the refugee camps. They can then provoke attacks on the countries harboring those refugees.
And that would just be the beginning in your list. You've got terrorism, exactly. A new sort of Afghanistan base for terrorism, radicalization of neighboring populations, secession breeding secessionism, countries breaking up, economic losses, not even to mention oil, and then neighborly intervention. Doesn't sound so neighborly. I mean, do you really see armies on the march potentially here?
Potentially you can. Again, it's something that is fairly common to these kind of civil wars. Typically what happens, and again, you're already starting to see it in Iraq, is that different neighboring countries see the country in question coming apart, and they start to intervene clandestinely, covertly, supporting different proxy groups in the country to use those proxy groups to try to secure their interests. But frequently, the proxy groups either don't do what they're told, or they are not up to the task, or simply one group starts to win. And when any of that happens, the countries, the neighboring countries, begin to think about using their own armed forces to actually solve the problems themselves. Again, it's something that you saw in Lebanon with Israel and the Syrians. It's something you saw in Congo with seven different nations intervening there.
I've been joined from Washington by Kenneth Pollack. He's former director for Persian Gulf Affairs at the National Security Council, 99 to 2001. He's director of research at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution in Washington. Just out with a big new report, and we're going to dive into it here on a dozen steps that he said might, if we're lucky, help us contain an out-of-control situation in Iraq. I'm also joined right now in the studio by Barry Posen, director of the Security Studies Program at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's also a professor of political science there, author of Inadvertent Escalation and the Sources of Military Doctrine. Barry Posen, thank you for being with us.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Ken.
First to Ken Pollack's and Dan Byman's analysis of the situation. Effort to achieve peace and stability failed, and Iraq descending rapidly into an all-out civil war. Do you see it that way?
I think I probably see it that way even more than Ken does. I think you are clearly in something we could call a civil war. The only thing that's missing is the blue and gray clad legions, you know, fighting each other up and down the length and breadth of the countryside. But aside from that, we have heavily armed militias from a variety of political and ethnic factions who are involved in something that sometimes looks like a war against all and sometimes looks like a fairly clear sectarian war.
So we're not debating the civil war label anymore. It's the all-out factor here that comes into play, I guess.
And the all-out question, I think, is a subtle one, and I managed to read about the first half of the report, and I wasn't that clear on what distinguished this from all-out civil war, but I take that the distinction is the collapse of the Iraqi army and then the organization of more or less conventional military forces fighting each other. That would be a state change. I think it's plenty bad the way it is, and a continuation and intensification of the current pattern of conflict, I think, is probably equally bad. And I don't really have a great deal of hope that the current array of administration policies, the new policies, are gonna work very well to halt the. It's not just escalation, but it's a kind of a regular transformation that happens. And I think we're, you know, as pessimistic as some of us have been about the course of this war from almost the beginning, it's somehow always been worse, and always been worse in a kind of a surprising way. So I think there are dynamics in this conflict that we don't fully understand, but those dynamics are very difficult to get a handle on now, and they're leading to, you know, to a very bad place. Mm.
Ken Pollack, your analysis very important to the debate in Washington right now, but at the same time almost makes it seem marginal or just getting at the edges of what needs to be considered by the Congress, the President, the American people here. A couple of steps here. First of all, define what's the shift that would mean the shift from what's going on now to all-out civil war. Describe that for us and then begin to take us, if you would, into the steps that you say we need to be urgently planning to contain that if and when it comes.
Sure. First, Tom, a little bit of truth in advertising. Mm. Your listeners should probably be aware that Barry Posen is my old professor and one of my mentors. And while I can't say that Barry taught me everything I know, he certainly did teach me all of the best things that I know.
There's history here in the world that you guys work in, and it's a kind of knotty thicket. Doesn't mean you're necessarily on the same page, but there's history. We got it.
No, that's right. And if Barry disagrees with anything I say, it's basically his own fault is what I'm saying.
Oh.
With regard to the shift, I think Barry's nailed it. The only real difference, what's basically preventing the kind of Bosnia-like or even Lebanon-like ethnic cleansing that we've seen elsewhere in Iraq, is the continued existence of the Iraqi government per se, particularly the military and the presence of American forces. But if the Iraqi center, the government, the military were to collapse into ethnic factions, and we've had threats of that at a variety of times, I think that you would see this this all-out civil war, a Bosnia-like civil war, a Lebanon-like civil war. As far as what to do about containing it, you're right. Dan, and my feeling was that we may have one last shot at stopping it. Dan and I are also very concerned about the president's plan, whether it can actually work. But put it this way, give it the benefit of the doubt, it certainly is our last chance to avert further catastrophe in Iraq.
To avert, in your view, the all-out situation you're describing. But let's look at that, begin to look at that dozen steps, suggestions that you make. And I mean, suggestions, every word seems too light here. These are such heavy consequential notions. But the first one kind of stunned me. Right out of the box, you say if it comes to all-out civil war, advice to the United States, do not try to pick winners. In other words, stand back and let it go.
To some extent, that's right. We looked hard at this because that's obviously one way that other states have tried to deal with this, is to focus on one group, back it, try to have it win the civil war. At the very least, that ought to bring the civil war to a close faster. It might result in fewer people dying. You might also have some control over the state that arises from it.
I think a lot of people would say they're a lot more Shia than Sunni, so let's get with the Shia.
Yeah. Well, here are the basic problems. There is no such thing as the Shia. The Shia are scores of different militias, most of them very small, three or four larger ones that people have heard of, like Jaish al-Mahdi and the Badr Brigades and Fadila. But even those are just mid-sized. They hate each other. They fight each other very frequently. And the first problem would be that you would have to unify the Shia. That's going to be something that is going to be very hard and very messy. Second, it is going to require a lot of violence on the part of the Shia to suppress the Sunnis. And if we back the biggest Shia militia, Jaish al-Mahdi, we might wind up with a genocidal form of violence. Jaish al-Mahdi is composed of some very nasty people who want to do some truly horrible things to the Sunnis. And then at the end of the day, there's a big question mark of what it is that we get left with. The two biggest Shia militias, the one who could most easily gain control over the Shia and then wage a war against the Sunni, are Jaish al-Mahdi, which is led by Muqtada as-Sadr, who hates the United States. It is a very nasty group of people. And the only alternative out there are the Badr Brigades, who are the group most closely tied to Iran. And so even if we were to do that, we might wind up with a country that isn't terribly helpful to U.S. interests, and that might be, in and of itself, a destabilizing force in the Persian Gulf.
Even more, you're right, you never know. Once civil war gets started, who will win? A great general, quote-unquote, could emerge from the Sunni. They could end up back in the saddle. And let's keep the scale of this in mind. You're talking hundreds of thousands of Iraqi casualties here for years and years. Your point, too, really came at me as well. It says, avoid active support for partition. There's a lot of talk about partition as a potential way out of this. You're saying avoid it if all-out civil war comes? Why? Couldn't that be a solution?
Right. Well, eventually it may be. And what we say in the report is that at some point in time, you might find yourself with the conditions for a stable partition. When that happens, we ought to back it. But partition is very difficult to do. Right now in Iraq, most Iraqis don't want partition. They want to rule most of the country. And certainly that's what the militia leaders want. It's worth thinking about the Bosnia analogy, because that's what most people in Washington think of when they talk about partition. There were three things that made the Dayton Accords possible with Bosnia. First, you had gone through horrific slaughter in Bosnia for 4 years, which brought not just the people, but their militia leaders as well, largely to the conclusion that they needed to make peace, they needed to end this. Second, you had three groups that were well-defined and led by leaders who could deliver deliver. Milosevic, Izzet Begovic, and Tudjman. Those three people do not exist in Iraq, nor are the people ready for that, nor are they so tired of it. And then last, you had massive foreign military intervention, first with the Allied Force operation to force the Serbs to the table, and then a major military deployment afterwards to nail it down. A military deployment in Bosnia, which scaled up for Iraq, would equate to about 300,000 to 400,000 troops there.
So we're talking
no one is ready for that yet.
About a different scale entirely. If you wanted to go in and try and actually quell this, you say in the report 450,000 troops and kind of unimaginable number, except the stakes are so high here. You go on saying pull back from population centers, don't dump it on the UN, don't think the UN can come in and even run the refugee camps, give support to Iraq's neighbors. We'll look at that. But Barry Posen, what about if it comes to this, if it's around the corner and it's coming uglier than we expect, what about these first three? Don't pick winners, don't partition, and you know, pull back from Iraqi population centers, and at least at first, it burns.
Well, you know, I think in general, the report does a good thing, which is to consider what our next, you know, America's next moves are going to be. I think Ken and Dan are basically right that the situation in Iraq is probably going to get worse, and at some point the United States may disengage, and there's a risk of an intensified civil war, and there's a risk of various kinds of regional spillover effects. Now, we should say, first of all, that there are risks. I mean, we should be very careful here. Ken and Dan are laying out possibilities. They're not all probabilities. And even if you read deeper into the text, you find that there's a lot of one hand on the other hand kind of discussions. And it's not a probability that all of these things will happen in sequence, and not all of them are necessarily as bad as all of the others. That said, a prudent American policy will try to buffer itself against these possibilities, right? And they suggest a range of measures, some of which I agree and some of which I do not agree. Now, on the point of picking winners, this is a kind of a favorite answer for students of ethnic conflict. The biggest problem that we're presented with in picking winners in Iraq today is that the political arithmetic doesn't work out. The only side that has a chance of winning are the Shiites, and America has so many Sunni Arab connections in the Persian Gulf with the Saudis and the Gulf states and everybody else that all these allies of ours are not going to thank us for establishing a Shiite hegemony in Iraq, for being
the tension afoot right now.
Yeah.
We can feel it.
So it's not on. I'm a little dubious about the discussion of partition, because I think, again, Ken and Dan sort of admit that something like partition is happening in the country. It's working itself out slowly. Many millions of people, you know, the refugees that he talks about being concerned about have already happened. There's 3 or 4 million refugees and internally displaced people. People are sorting themselves out. I think the United States has a decision to make, and then is which, you know, there's really only two doors we can push on here, right? We can either try and push the situation in the direction of recentralization of the state, a strong state, which is, by the way, what the Baker-Hamilton Commission recommended in a strange way, or we can push on the direction of things, right? Push in the direction things are going. Right?
Falling apart.
Yes, and try and make it as humane and as organized as it can. And I think Ken is right that we don't want to have ownership of a big partition plan. But I think we have to decide for ourselves whether we're going to try and get in the way of this process or trying to help it along and make it more humane. And I think if you look at the government actions that we're demanding of the Shia, these are all actions that basically move decentralization along. New law and oil revenues moves decentralization along. New provincial elections moves the thing along, right? So the United States government has already sort of secretly agreed that decentralization is the right pattern, right? And I think we're going to follow it. Then the final thing is the question of staying out. And here I think we're going to learn over the next 6 months, right, just how much direct intervention between the two parties, the United States government and its military, really wants to participate in and can do any good in. And my sense is we're going to learn that we can't do much good. We're often going to be very concerned about who the hell is shooting at us. This microcosm story of this operation in Baghdad that appeared in the New York Times in the last couple of days gives you a kind of the flavor of the situation that you're going to be in. And so I think sort of trying to stand in the middle of this thing at some point will probably prove to be costly, prove to be unproductive, and will anger anger both parties. So I think that part of the recommendation is right, but I think it's only a half measure. Ken wants to get out of Baghdad, but go out to the countryside. I think we have to get out of the country.
Ken Pollack talks exactly about that, maybe not being in the middle of it, but very much and active at the edges. We'll look at that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let me take a call. Sam is calling from Lincoln, Massachusetts. Hi, Sam. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Very impressed with the degree of analysis, the detail. These people are really thinking hard on this, and it really hurts to see this analysis now. So I guess my first point before I ask my question is, was there this kind of thinking going on before we went into Iraq? And I bring this up because it seems like we keep making the same mistakes over and over again. And here's my question. We can't really have an intelligent conversation about Iraq unless we know what our intentions are. And for the life of me, I've been trying to explain to my son why we went to war in Iraq. He's 10 years old, a fourth grader. And I haven't been able to give him an answer. We know all the things that were the diversions, the lies, the manipulations. But unless we know why we're there, citizens can't make an intelligent decision, much less an understanding, unless we know what our goals are.
And what about the great leap forward in this catastrophe scenario, Sam, that says, well, at this point, we're there to keep the whole region from melting down and to keep the lights on?
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that's for second graders. I'm talking about for fourth graders. My son wants to know, why are we there?
Very advanced.
He's an advanced kid. Why are we there? Because you got to go somewhere for a reason. And I've not been able to give him a reason why we're there. We know the reasons we weren't there. We know the manipulations, the things that we told the second graders. But I'm trying to bring this up a notch to my son's level. And so I'd ask your guests if they could at least agree on why we went to Iraq, and then we can have an intelligent conversations of what
yeah,
to do.
Sam, we got it. And I mean, I think there's the questions on both sides of that. We've endlessly talked about why we're there, and I agree. The answer is vague. At the same time, here's this new vista opening up in front of us, and it's not pretty. Ken Pollack, how do you respond to Sam?
Well, I think without getting into the big question of why we went in there, because you're right, ultimately, Tom, there are a lot of different people who had a lot of different reasons. Some of them were good. Some of them were bad. Even some of the good ones were mistaken. Some of my reasons fall into that category. But for me, the real question mark is this question of what are our intentions moving forward? How do our interests change if it becomes clear that the president's plan is not going to work and therefore it really isn't going to be possible for us to stabilize the country and build a stable Iraq that can move forward into the 21st century? And there we started to talk about it. The problem that we have with Iraq is that it is located in an incredibly important part of the world. We may not like to talk about the fact that our economy and the global economy is underpinned by cheap, plentiful oil, but that is the fact of the matter. Mm. I'm heartened by the fact that President Bush has now woken up to this and is at least saying that it's a bad thing that we are addicted to oil. I note that we've gone to war in the Persian Gulf three times since 1987 because of the region's importance as an oil producer. I'd love to see us not go to war in the region three more times in the next 17 or 18 years by weaning ourselves and the world off of that dependence.
Linda's calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Linda. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think the problem is that people like Mr. Pollack don't like to admit that they've made a terrible mistake, and Americans don't like to admit that we can't fix things. But it is over in Iraq. We lost. We can't fix it. We have to face that directly, say we screwed up, it's over, and we have to get out. And that's the only thing that we can do.
But Linda, what if the party we were invited to is over, but a new, worse party is opening up here that could, among other things, put the whole region in flames and cut off the oil that keeps the lights on, the power and the heat in your furnace in Iowa? It's cold out there.
We can't stop that.
We can't? Don't we have to? Can you just say, oh, well, there goes Saudi Arabia's oil? I don't know.
No, that's our failure. We think that because it's like Bush said, it's going to work this time because I told the generals it had to. Just because it has to, just because it's going to be utterly catastrophic if it isn't fixed, doesn't mean it can be fixed.
Let me put it to my guest, Ken Pollack, to you first. Is there a walk-away option here?
Sure. First, let me just respond to Linda's first point. I think she's right that we made a terrible mistake. I've said that any number of times. I've written it about 5 different times, so I at least am willing to admit to my mistakes. But I think that you're right, Tom. The problem with Iraq is that our interests don't end with Iraq, and just because we are failing in Iraq and look like we are going to fail doesn't mean that we can simply walk away from the problem. I want to emphasize a point that Barry made, because he's absolutely right. What we're talking about in our report are risks. They are very serious risks. They are very real risks, but they are risks. They are not certainties. And as he put it very nicely, a prudent American political body would be guarding against those risks and taking steps to do so. That's what we try to do in the report. Linda may ultimately be right that we ultimately may not be able to stop a catastrophe from ensuing if all-out civil war in Iraq breaks out. But our point is that the United States needs to be thinking about it now. We went into Iraq blithely. The administration refused to think about or prepare for the worst case. That's why we have the worst case. When we withdraw from Iraq, if we are going to withdraw from Iraq, I think that we need to be thinking about and preparing for the worst case that could ensue from that as well.
But are you saying
there are things we can do?
You're a strategic thinker. Do you agree that the United States can, given its national interest, can, could walk away from an all-out civil war spilling over into the region, fulfilling exactly the narrative that you lay out here of all these countries engaged, you know, huge death, oil supplies disrupted? Can the United States, as a matter of national security, survival, do that? Can it walk away?
Yeah. As a strategic thinker, I do not think that we can walk away from the region. We may be able to walk away from Iraq, and that's a point of debate between Barry and myself. But I don't think, and I think Barry would probably agree, that we can walk away from the region. And that's the concern, is can civil war in Iraq hurt the rest of the region, make it so, as you're suggesting, that we have serious oil disruptions as a result? That we can't allow to happen, that we do need to take steps to try to prevent.
Barry Posen, the walk-away option, Ken says one of some prudent planning here, but the language in here suggests, you know, we're on the path to Hades right now, and this isn't some sort of intellectual exercise. These are things that need to be imminently considered. What about the walk-away scenario?
I come back to the point that Sam made, the previous caller, where he said that, you know, did people think this hard about Iraq before going in? And some people did, but the U.S. government didn't. One of the things that's striking about the Iraq debate now is that there's a huge burden of proof put on those of us who think it's time to walk away, right, to try and address these issues. A much bigger burden of proof was put on those who adventurously wanted to go into Iraq.
Well, so that's I'm more struck, though, Barry, by how the stakes aren't being described.
There's a kind of shining us on going on from Washington.
If it's as serious as this, what about walk away then?
I think these issues have been discussed. Now, I think you have to distinguish between walking away from Iraq and walking away from the Gulf. Now, I agree with Linda about one thing, right? And I think whether Ken wants to admit it or not, I think his discussion about oil dependency on Persian Gulf oil leads you in this direction. It is time for this country to have in its foreign policy debate a serious engagement with the question of whether or not our strategic commitment to the Gulf as a whole is an intelligent thing for us to be doing. The costs in dollars are very high. I think it doesn't take much accounting to attribute a third of the defense budget to the Gulf problem.
But aren't we on two different timelines here?
We're getting, no, not necessarily.
I mean, you could walk away maybe years from now, but right now, what portion of our oil comes? Do we have a choice? Are you going to shut down the factories, shut off the heat? It's cold out there.
I think you need to know what oil does in this society. Oil runs cars in this society. Imported oil runs cars in this society. It doesn't run factories. It doesn't run, on the whole, it doesn't heat people's homes. The big user of Persian Gulf oil is cars.
But aren't you talking long term when these threats are potentially near term, potentially imminent?
You are talking long term, but I think you want to be very careful about, as I said earlier, that you're talking about possibilities, not probabilities. And I think you also have to, you know, go through the Gulf and ask yourself, sort of, you know, where, in some sense, are the breakpoints? In other words, you know, in Ken's study, for example, he seems to be concerned about the implications of Iraqi oil going off the market. Mm-hmm. Well, Iraqi oil is really not very much oil, and if Iraqi oil goes off the market, it'll raise prices somewhat. And this is not really a very important question.
But they also raise the prospect effect of Saudi oil, for that matter, Iranian.
The bigger question is Saudi oil. Saudis are the big producers of oil in the Persian Gulf, and it's the one that makes the biggest difference. And you have to ask yourself, what are the range of risks to Saudi oil that comes from this kind of a problem? And for us to get to that place, a whole series of dominoes have to fall. Now, you can still make the argument. I think you can make the argument that it's time for the United States to start backing away in its military commitment to the Gulf, which I think is an implicit subsidy of the price of oil, and start capturing the security risks of oil dependency in the price of oil, because until those risks are captured in the price of a barrel of oil, all of the substitution, all of this conservation, all of these new technologies are not going to appear in the marketplace as being economically viable. And that's because there's a U.S. DOD subsidy in the price of a world barrel of oil that I think is actually a rather big subsidy. Now, I'm not 100% sure of this, but this is an argument that we have to open and begin discussing seriously in this country.
I'm all for it, and it sounds great, but it does seem long-term. $100 barrel oil, if that's what this should turn into in the nearer term, could throw such a monkey wrench in that we won't be around in the state we're in now to talk about it coolly
later. I think
you
want to be very careful with that argument, Tom. I think we need to ask the American people the blunt question, right? Are you prepared to fight endless wars in the Persian Gulf, right, to protect a price of a gallon of gas at $2.50 a gallon rather than $5?
Ken Pollack, what about it? Point 10 on your, you know, steps to prepare. Prepare for oil supply disruptions. Is weaning ourselves off Middle East oil or walking away from a security commitment to keeping it flowing an option in the time frame that you're looking at here?
Yeah, I certainly agree with Barry's points, and that was the point that I was trying to get at before, that our dependence on Persian Gulf oil is very unhealthy. It's not clear that it makes economic sense. But as you're also suggesting, Tom, I think in the short term, it's something that is very hard to walk away from. I think that the oil disruptions that we could, and I will stress could, suffer from the spillover from a major Iraqi civil war could be devastating to us. You know, we should remember what happened after the Iranian Revolution when Iranian oil production, Iran was not the leading oil producer at the time, went from 6 million barrels per day to about 1 million barrel per day in a course of about 6 months and caused the 1979 oil price shock. With Saudi Arabia, as Barry points out, it could be much, much worse. And again, it's not to say that it is going to happen or even that there is a high likelihood, but the possibility is so catastrophic that we need to be preparing for that. And I also think that at the end of the day, Barry's right. This is where we need to be going. We need to be thinking about whether this is smart for this country and whether we shouldn't be moving toward a very different kind of economic system, one that does not rely on petroleum from the Persian Gulf. I think we would be much better off.
Go green by all means, but for right now, the plans you outlined, number 13, is not pulling U.S. troops out of there. It's having tons of U.S. troops on Iraq's borders. You say consider establishing safe havens or catch basins along the borders for masses of refugees and to contain potential outflow of terrorists, fighters, you name it. What would that look like? Paint a picture.
Well, it could be wonderful. It could be very ugly. Again, it's not clear. The scenario can run in a variety of directions. But basically what we're talking about is when we looked at these historical patterns of spillover from civil wars, we basically saw refugees, militiamen crossing border, terrorists crossing borders, and armies crossing borders as four of the biggest problems.
And dragging neighbors into the fight.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways that the United States and other countries have in the past dealt with this is by establishing refugee collection points where you can care and feed and clothe large numbers of refugees, and you set up beyond them larger buffer zones that make it hard for the terrorists and the militiamen to move back and forth and make it very hard for the neighboring armies to cross the borders. The best example of this was Operation Provide Comfort, which was the operation that the United States set up in Iraq in 1991. After the Persian Gulf War in the north, where we set up refugee points in northern Iraq to care for Kurdish refugees and established a buffer zone, both to keep the Iraqi army out of northern Iraq and to prevent the Turks from moving in.
So a kind of combination of refugee care and buffer police all in one. That sounds like a very funky zone. How many troops would that take? Iraq's a pretty big country.
Yes, it is. And what we were looking at for most of the country would probably require a presence of about 60 to 80,000 American troops within the country and probably another 20 or 30,000 providing logistical support outside it. And, of course, that's one of the downsides of it. It means, as Barry keeps emphasizing, that American troops remain inside Iraq, where they could remain the target of terrorist attack and where they could interpose themselves between the Iraqi civil war and our allies. That would also put us into a very difficult state. And then a last point, which no one has raised, is that while we talk about the merits of the catch basin system, we also recognize the potential downsides. And one of the big ones is it will be very difficult to prevent Iranian interference in Iraq using those catch basins, which could be very efficient at keeping Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Jordan, the Sunni states out, but would have a very difficult time keeping the Iranians out.
Mm. And they're right in the middle of this. Lay down red lines for them. You say, let me take a call. Lukman from Boston. Hi, Lukman, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
And my best regards for your guest. I have to respectfully disagree with your guest about the partition. He mentioned that partitioning is not a good solution.
Well, Lachman, my note here says that you're an Iraqi Kurd. Do you want partition?
It is partition. It isn't partition on the ground. You cannot be, as a Shia, you cannot live in a Sunni area. You cannot live as a Kurd in a Shia or Sunni area. It has been partitioned on the ground.
Already?
Already it has been partitioned. So what the solution has to be, embrace this and don't waste so much more money and energy and let the things take the natural thing. For example, Iraq was created in 1920, and it was a big mistake by the British. And throughout the 85 years of Iraq, it was proven to be a failed country.
Yeah, Lukman, our time is short, but we take your point. It's going to be a big temptation to say, just let it go into pieces. Barry, let's come back to that. I mean, it's going to be, people are going to be powerfully interested in it. If the alternative looks so distasteful, could it not work?
What, partition?
Yes.
There have been a variety of partition plans suggested. I think I think where the debate is going is basically towards a weak sort of legal Iraqi central state with the various communities and factions essentially governing themselves. So it's devolution of power to provinces or regions. And the fact is, I think that if you look at the Iraqi constitution, which we in a way helped write, it includes essentially all these provisions in it. In other words, we've sort of set up a legal structure that drives in that direction. So it's not only the politics of the country, it's the legal structure. Now, people who point out that it's not going to be pretty to organize this are right. And the fact is it's already been unpretty. These populations are sorting themselves out because they're deathly afraid, right? And that's, in the end, what induces people to move.
And for good
reason. We should be prepared to do, I think, is to help them move without too much risk, and to try and ease their resettlement in parts of Iraq. And rather than have them resettle in camps on the border, you know, we should look at some of these cities that are half wrecked, like Fallujah and Ramadi, if you saw the picture in the New York Times today, and figure out, you know, how and where are we going to start throwing some money at rebuilding these cities. And the Arab states in the region who have an interest in not being visited by these refugee flows should have an interest in funding the resettlement of these people within Iraq.
Put some big money in there. A last question. Our time grows short, but for you, Barry, we care about the instincts that take us in one way, direction or another here. There are instincts that took us into this war. What do you think of Ken Pollack's, 13-step plan for dealing with all-out civil war? Are the right instincts here, or are we still being pushed? Are we being pushed unnecessarily toward a kind of militarized solution to this? Is there another way or not?
Well, you have to deal with it at different levels. I mean, I have a lot of respect for Ken, but the woman who basically spoke from her heart, Linda, I guess, has said, look, you have to give up this idea that you're going to control. I think there's still a little bit too much control in the story that Ken and Dan are telling. There's just too much fine-tuning. And they have some general arguments in there where they say a few places, don't do half measures. And, of course, if you look at students of strategy, like Clausewitz, they always say, avoid things that are excessively subtle, right? I think there's a few things that we should be worried about here. We should be worried about refugees, largely for humanitarian reasons, but also for political reasons. And we should be worried about the possibility of knockdown, drag-out international war. Knockdown, drag drag out international war be bad for everybody. In the short term, it's bad for oil markets. The United States has a lot of leverage to prevent all out international war. And I'm not even clear that the local countries really want to get close to all out international war. So if we can think about trying to reduce our risks there and to reduce pain and suffering of refugees somehow, I think you will have achieved a lot. And some of the other fine-tuning, I think, is just demanding too much.
Ken Pollack, I'm afraid we have just half a minute, but could this approach be too controlling? Do we have to loosen up, or can we not afford that?
Well, certainly it could be. The problem, of course, is that what we're talking about is managing failure, and managing failure is extraordinarily difficult. And what we're trying to do is lay out 13 different steps that the United States could employ to try to buffer Iraq and to diminish the likelihood. In point of fact, I don't think that it's quite as controlling as Barry is suggesting, but we are trying to stay more engaged than I think Barry wants. Mm. Our point is simply that, as I said, our interests don't end if Iraq falls into civil war. In some ways, they only begin then, because then the threat arises to the countries that really matter to us, like Saudi Arabia, like Kuwait, like Jordan.
Ken Pollack, we will talk again, I'm sure. We thank you for your time and your thoughts. Ken Pollack of the Saban Center at the Brookings Institution, thanks for being with us. And Barry Posen of MIT, thank you for joining us. This is On Point.